Welcome to Witch Hunt. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack. Welcome, Stacey Schiff, Pulitzer Prize-winning author known for her compelling narratives and deep research into historical events and figures. Her notable works include The Witches, Suspicion, Betrayal, and Hysteria, and 1692 Salem. What are some major misconceptions people have about the Salem witch trials?
Oh my goodness, it's a long and distinguished list, isn't it? I think generally people tend to assume that people burned, not hanged. So I think that's the first one. I think the general assumption is that all the victims were women. But as we know, 5 men were also victims that year. They were not universally poor women. They were not older women. There was a 5-year-old who was accused as well. Because I think we take a lot of what we understand to have been the history from Arthur Miller, I think we have assumed that voodoo and naked dancing in the forest were part of it. And that's taken from The Crucible, either the play or the movie, not from the actual events of 1692. And I think the word Salem is slightly misleading because 25 communities wind up being involved in any case, not only the town of Salem. And I guess the biggest misconception is that there were witches, of which there were none.
And what are some of the theories about how the Salem witch hunt happened?
I think that the epidemic that year, the panic that year, has been pretty much written down to anything you can possibly think of, from regional hostilities to class conflict to tensions within the church to food poisoning to teenage hysteria to fraud to taxes, political instability, trauma due to the frontier with the Native Americans, the weather. You could go mad actually staring at the events and trying to pick a pattern. As with all things, if you're really looking for a pattern, you could almost always find one, which is something of a key to what happens that year. So I think many of those things have been applied and then discarded. And I think we can get into this. One of the issues, of course, with that year is that so many forces come into play that it isn't predominantly actually one thing. There isn't a key, as much as we would like for there to be one. There isn't a key to the Salem witch epidemic of that year.
And how did you manage to clarify the true causes behind the witch trials? You made them so easy to understand for the readers, despite the reputation for the mystery and the complexity.
Well, thanks, Sarah. That's a lovely way to put it. I hope it's clear. I think what I did is that when I started the research, I read through all of the paper that survives. And it's about 1,000 pages of, as the court papers are missing, but we have about 1,000 pages of arrest documents or depositions or jailers' accounting. We have about 1,000 pages of paper. And I read through all of that and tried to make that material really speak for itself in some way, because you can see the story mutating from beginning to end. What initially passes for witchcraft when the first girls are afflicted is not what will be discussed as witchcraft by late summer, when this thing has really snowballed to just tremendous effect. So you can begin to tease out who's carrying the narrative and how the narrative twists and turns, and what the sources of that are. And I guess to that end, I would cite two things. I went back and I read all 8 or 9, I can't remember any longer, volumes of the records and files of the Quarterly Courts of Essex County, which is not, it's to the years prior to 1692, but it is a complete record of all of the, these are very litigious people. These are all of the collisions in court that all of these families had over these years. And the same issues and the same names come up, as you will later see in some of the witchcraft accusations. So that was almost like a template to both the sensibility and the history of these people. It's interesting that about half of the women who hang had been accused previously of witchcraft. There's obviously some lingering resentment or some lingering questions here. And then the other, from a textual point of view, the other great guide was the writings of Cotton Mather, the minister who's at the young minister who is at the center of the trials, and who had written a bestseller in which he had incorporated an account of the European witchcraft, a Swedish witchcraft panic of years earlier, which infiltrates the New England drinking water and which bears a mark on Salem. There's actually, I think, a great doctoral thesis to be written about this, because he imports elements from Sweden that had never before been seen in any kind of New England witchcraft testimony. That's a long answer to your extremely good question, but that was how I began to decode it. You can see, I read all of the sermons that the girls would have heard that year, and you can see bits and pieces of that sermon in their testimony. You can see that they're recycling the imagery that they've heard on Sundays.
And what were some of the factors which actually did lead to the Salem witch trials?
I guess the chief one, this is an overdetermined event. It's very hard, as I said, to tease one thing or another thing out. I would say more than anything, the question that year becomes not what was afflicting these young women, but why was the court so intent on prosecution? Because there had been witchcraft accusations before, there had been outbreaks of witchcraft before. Never before had there been this kind of prosecution where no one who walked into that courtroom exited innocent. And for that, I would say that it was something of the political environment, which makes that year stand apart. You have on this court a group of men who, for reasons of their own, given political instability of the previous few years, need to prove they are a law and order administration. And in particular, the Chief Justice of the court, who has been something of a political, he's been very ambidextrous politically, he's played both sides repeatedly, needs to prove that he is solely in command and is not going to relax his hold. And he is the one who's pushing, it's very clear to us, he's the one who's pushing for convictions. So I think the politics is something that we haven't necessarily paid enough attention to in the past. I think, as I said, some of those earlier accusations, some of that sense of suspicion that had never really been dissipated before. And you really do have a community that's very much under fire. Salem Village, which is where the first girls begin to show signs of some sort of affliction of some disorder, is a village that has had serious trouble with its ministers. And in different ways, all of those prior ministers will play a role in what happens this year. But the minister in whose household the witchcraft, so to speak, breaks out, is under siege with in his community. He's at war with his parishioners, and he's very much driving these events forward in some ways.
Were there any other primary actors who caused the witch trials to proceed as they did? And if you're interested in following that with what halted the witch trials?
So yeah, I think you could probably draw something of a schematic if you wanted to just take like how does this thing snowball? What are the bases it has to hit to produce this storm of accusations? And I think this household under siege, obviously, it's a hothouse environment. You have these girls living in a situation where they can see that their father and uncle is in disfavor with the community. So there's a sense of an explosion within that household. One of the first people accused, as you know, is Titima, the Indian slave in the household. And Titima's testimony is so vivid and so kaleidoscopic and so convincing that she's one of the only one of the three first accused who says, yes, witchcraft was at work. Yes, I flew on a pole to Boston with my accomplices. And moreover, I saw these spectral cats, crazy testimony. Once she has established in the eyes of the community that witchcraft has been at work, it's very hard for anybody to reverse course. So that's another sort of post on the way. And then one of the first girls who testifies, a teenager named Abigail Hobbs, who's the bad girl of Topsfield, she then spreads the accusations out beyond Salem Village because she suddenly points a finger toward a former minister of the town and of the village, in fact. And so there you begin to see that the thing has tentacles and it begins to spread beyond the immediate household. And then I guess I should add, actually, Thomas Putnam, one of the villagers, who has had a run of terrible luck and who will complain against, I think, 35 of the ultimate accused witches, and who will file the first charges. He does something as well to help this thing explode. And then from the other side, you have the head of the witchcraft court, Stoughton, and you have Cotton Mather, who's always in the background, trying very hard to help advise the court, but always in a way that seems to press them toward prosecution. As much as he's pretending to be even-handed, he seems quite intent on somehow exorcising this ill and purifying the community. So you have these other forces that are both massaging the narrative and enforcing the prosecution. It's hard to say what single element shuts down the prosecution. A number of things happen, and I think the timing is crucial as well. The witchcraft breaks out in late January, early February. The trials take place largely over the summer. And by fall, the accusations have begun to spread in every direction. We've got to the point where it is far easier to accuse someone else or to confess than it is to claim your innocence. And so obviously in that situation, the snowballing is out of control. It's also, however, the fall, which is traditionally the season when you wanted to make sure that you had plenty of stores in your cellar and you were ready for the winter. And so the interest in spending all day in witchcraft courtrooms tended to wane a little bit. So it may be that a healthy dose of skepticism begins to creep in for practical reasons. It's also true that the newly appointed, newly installed Massachusetts governor is not a Puritan. He doesn't buy into these trials the way the other authorities had. And he reaches out late that year to the New York ministers to get their opinion on what's happening in Salem. And that's the first attempt to go beyond the kind of monolith, which is the New England establishment. And their opinion is very different from what the judges in Massachusetts are hearing. So you get this outside opinion as well. And slowly but surely, you get people in the community. And Thomas Brattle would be the best instance of this. He's a 35-year-old Boston merchant who doesn't have any relationship to any of the other well-born justices, which is unusual because they are a very inbred, familiar group one to the other. And who realizes that basically if someone gives testimony with her eyes closed, she's not observing what's happening, she's imagining something, and sees that a great miscarriage of justice is taking place and will be very hard to erase from history. And very quietly, and in fact anonymously, he writes a small pamphlet about the court's proceedings. And he is one of two voices. There's a Boston minister as well, also very quietly, who will begin to speak up against the trials. And it may be that at that point, the accusations have just reached a very high level and too many important people have been implicated. It may just be that it begins to stretch the imagination. At first, there had been five witches and then there had been 10 witches and suddenly there were 500 witches. And it may be, it's as if suddenly everyone awoke from this great delirium is what it does begin to feel like. Even at that juncture, there are two things that are interesting. One is that Stone, the Chief Justice, is unwilling to shut down the court, and he has to be forced to shut down the court because he's convinced still of his rectitude and of the court's probity in prosecuting. And secondly, and this I think is something we tend to lose sight of, the belief in witchcraft will persist well after the trials. People believe that they themselves were innocent or that the accused that year were innocent, but they don't yet lose their faith in witchcraft. It's an interesting thing where the trials end, but there is still this lingering sense that there was something supernatural at work.
What key lessons should be learned from the Salem witch hunt and applied today?
I suppose we should avoid jumping to conclusions. This is what happens when fear paralyzes reason and when we overcorrect and sort of overanalyze. And I guess what the best that could be said for this real mishap, this tragedy, is that it should serve as a sort of vaccine for us all. We have this instance in our record. We should be looking at it and using it when we think we might be heading in this direction so we don't end up with McCarthyism, basically. We've seen this, we've seen the dynamic so vividly so often, and it is so clearly where you end up going if you head down the road of conspiratorial thinking. This is the end of the road. And as early as really Thomas Brattle's writings that year, people were very aware of the fact that this was something that was going to be a stain on history and that was going to be there, a blinking red light or a guardrail for future times, which is indeed how we should be looking at it. It's always been interesting to me. It's very much in line with Richard Hofstadter's paranoid style in American politics, but it doesn't figure in that book. But it really is the beginning of that, this the overheated rhetoric and the need, this tribal need to prosecute in some way, and the inability to basically defer to reason when you realize that the reasonable is actually the right solution. Somehow the complicated answer seems somehow like the more appealing answer often.
And thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
Join us again every week.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.